Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to another week where I introduce you to another fabulous guest, another incredible human being making this world a more beautiful place. And this week's guest is named Mariana Cooper, who is so beautifully complex and has so many different things that she's done in her life that as the conversation unfolded, I kind of just sat back and went along for the ride. I mean, besides her being an author and an intuitive and an actor and, my goodness, having a BA in psychology and MBA in marketing, she's also been a ballroom dancer and she's an acclaimed intuitive life strategist. She also was the host of the Aha Moments radio show, and so she has several hundred podcast episodes on Apple and several other platforms. Again, another person, I met her and I could have talked to her forever. She has lots to say that is beautiful, all-encompassing, generous of spirit, and wise. So I'm really excited this week to introduce you to Mariana, who also likes to be called Mari. And let's get into it. Here's my interview with Mariana Cooper.
I was at the time in acting classes downtown in I was at HB Studio. So that was downtown. And we went to class and we, you know, did our whole scene study and all that stuff. And I had a couple of friends that, you know, from acting class, and we finished class and we went to a pizzeria, and I had my bag on the back of my chair. And when we went to pay for our pizza, my bag was gone. It was gone. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any credit cards. We didn't have cell phones at the time. And I ended up, my friends actually said, well, we have other things to do. Good luck. One of them gave me $20, and then they left me. And I was in the city by myself.
My first question always is, if you were to go to a party or a conference and you had to get up on a stage or introduce yourself to a group of people, how would you do that?
Oh boy, that's a big one. I think I would say, hi, I'm Mari, Mariana Cooper, but Mari is what everybody calls me. And I'm on a path that I'd like to invite you to join. And that is a path to finding the rest of you, the part of you that has been traveling along, but without voice, and that you've probably been stumbling into and didn't realize that it was there for your support. And I pretty much can guarantee you've been operating with 20% of what you've got, even if you're over-indexing, even if you're hyper-successful, and I'd like to help you get the other 80%.
We need more of you in the world. I'm just going to put that out there. Well, when you were a kid, you know, what did you dream about being? What was your kind of fantasy vocation?
I want to be a farmer. I literally came out of the womb saying, can I have a goat? Can I have a German shepherd? Can I have a horse? I wanted to be a farmer. I literally, at the age of four, so I was a military brat. My dad was in the service. He was in the army for 21 years. And I was born in New York. And then we moved to Germany. Or tour, forget, because he had to tour in Germany. So we were there, and I spoke German before I spoke English. My nanny was Tante Hilda. I called my grandmother Oma and my grandfather Opa, and I literally spoke German before I spoke English. Then we moved back home, and my dad would give, like, when other kids were getting, like, toys and things, my dad would give me real estate magazines of ranches and farms. And he said, someday I'm going to buy you a ranch or a farm, pick out your farm. Because he knew I was always talking about farms. There was a show, and I'm going to really date myself because I'm old. But there was a show called Timmy and Lassie. And it was this, based on a farm. It was like, it was Lassie and Timmy, and they would just do these adventures on their farm. And, you know, Lassie would get them out of trouble and stop the bear from eating them up and all the things. And I was just like, I need a collie dog, and I need to be on a farm. And so my parents started to take me to a dairy farm every summer. So that was my summer vacations, was working a dairy, like an active working dairy farm. I helped deliver calves. I did the milking every day with like a big dairy operation. We lived in a farmhouse. And, you know, I was the only little brown kid at 8 years old that was a subscriber to Hordes Dairyman magazine. They were like, how many heads of cattle do you have? I had goat husbandry books. I cleaned out the shed. I mean, this is Long Island. Like, we're in Nassau County, Long Island, like a quarter acre per house. And I'm like cleaning out the tool shed so I can get a goat in there somehow. So yes, I wanted to be a farmer. And to this day, I still want to farm. Like I have horses now, and I import horses from Europe and stuff. So that's a whole other conversation. I have one horse now. I shouldn't say horses, but yeah. So I'm still, it set me right on a.
Wow.
I have a German Shepherd. I don't have a goat, but I will.
Well, I don't know. That is just absolutely fascinating. And the fact that it almost sounds like you came out of the womb wanting to be a farmer and having this kind of affinity for animals. And then for your summer vacations, you go and you work on a dairy farm. I am gobsmacked right now and delighted. I mean, where do you think that came from?
I'm sure it was a past life of some sort, as many past lives. I still, to this day, I'm constantly reading homesteading magazines. I've been looking at, you know, farms that I'd love to buy. That's my goal, you know, is to have that. I have a horse, and I was blessed because my parents, my mother in particular, really took whatever I said I was passionate about to heart. And I was riding, she took me from the dairy farm thing. We went to a camp. We had a Girl Scout trip and we went to a dude ranch, and all the other kids were playing pinball and swimming. And I was at the barn. I couldn't get me out off the horses. They couldn't get me out of the barn. So my mom put me in riding lessons at, I think, 11. And by the time I was 12, I started half leasing horses at this riding academy she put me in. And I was at that riding academy for 14 years. Got my first horse when I was 19. So I've been on living a farm life, even though I'm living a normal, regular person's life, just, you know, boarding my horse, whatever. And I think it's just, my parents were really, they loved animals. They didn't have farm animals. My mother raised Karen Terriers, like Toto and the Wizard of Oz. So they really helped us to really value critters. But my mom did always call me Dr. Doolittle, and we had everything. We had guinea pigs and birds and dogs and cats and rabbits and, you know, so my sister was like that too. Although she didn't want a farm, but I go to a farm every day because I go to see my horse. So it's just my grounded place. But I also think energetically, you know, when you're out in nature like that, the land is its own character in the show, right? The land is there to help you cycle through yourself, you know, and the trees, like I had special trees and special spots, special lakes and special ponds. And, you know, there was just special even flowers that would come up every year, like patches of flower, the peony patch or the, you know, the various things. And to be able to go and pick an ear of corn off your stalk and go and cook it, you know, that whole farm to table thing is a real thing. It really, there's a nourishment, a cycle of nourishment, I think. You know, I'm a Leo. I would love a Rolex. That'd be nice. But, but I'd much rather have a farm. You know what I mean? Like, Leos, you know, we like the things. But, I think the experiences and the feeling of presence is really important. And that's what that kind of, that space gives you.
I have to say, before we actually started, you know, the official interview, you and I were talking about these crows that follow you around the neighborhood, and that your dog earlier today was barking or talking to the crows and they were having a conversation. And now hearing all these stories, it suddenly makes sense. The crows are probably like, she actually can talk to us. We're just waiting for her to notice that. I love asking this because I've never been able to ask this before. And I am curious, as a child, or I mean, now reflecting back as a child, kind of working on that dairy farm, what is one of your favorite memories?
Giving, helping. Well, there's two things. One is that one of the cows, her name was Preserve, let you sit on her while she was being milked, while she was eating her supper, because they would come in and they would get hay. They'd have, you know, and they come into their various stations and you would wash their udders and everything and put the machines on. And Preserve was just a sweet cow and you could sit on her. So I would sit on her. I mean, I was, you know, 9 years old. And the other was when they called me to help deliver a calf. So I got to help deliver the babies, you know. And of course, you always wanted a girl, because if it was a boy, it would end up being veal. You know, it's like, you know, like for a cow to continuously give milk, it has to continuously stay in a gestational process. So they always have to be pregnant or postpartum.
Right.
And they, as soon as they're able to carry again, so that they're continuously producing milk. So there's always this cycle of life on a dairy farm. And it was really powerful to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and help, you know, a little one into the world and naming them. And yeah, that was very, very powerful, especially so young, you know, you're really seeing the cycle of life at that age.
Absolutely. And I was thinking, or I kind of felt or knew what you were going to say about wanting it to be a girl, because the boys get sent to the veal hut. And I've always thought veal was just the most awful. Yeah, it's totally disgusting and just horrifying to me. And I can't believe that we actually do it as a species. But I wanted to ask, you know, my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? And, you know, if so, when you started working at the dairy farm and when you started having these encounters with animals, did that change maybe your way of, you know, interacting or understanding spirit or the universe?
Well, you ask really good questions and I have a very weird life, so this is all working out great. So my grandmother was a very interesting being. So my grandmother was this petite little fashionista of the 70s, you know, and she had her platform shoes. I got my first platform shoes from my grandmother and my first leather jacket from my grandmother. And she would take me to Bloomingdale's, New York City, and Saks and all these things. I mean, you know, like iconic. But she would also take me to the health food store in our little town. We had we lived in this village, this walking village, and we'd go to the health food store, and she taught me all about organic food, and she taught me all about supplements. This was like the 70s. I mean, this was no Whole Foods type of thing. This was like the little hole in the wall, smells like sawdust when you walk in kind of, you know. And so she was spiritual, and she believed that somebody had to be right. So she was both Jewish and Catholic. And what she would do is she took a Star of David and she took a Miraculous Medal of Mary and she had them soldered together and she wore both. And she also had garlic knots in our ceilings and amulets all over the house and would like do all kinds of healing modalities and take us to the health food store, because she said, somebody's got to be right. So we're just going to say yes to all of them. Okay. But meanwhile, my mother had me in Catholic schools. I went to a Lutheran school when we lived in Hawaii, because we lived in Hawaii for 4 years. So she had me in Lutheran school for like kindergarten through in first grade. Then I was in Catholic school for all of my elementary and an all girls Catholic high school. And at the same time, she was studying with Shirley MacLaine about channeling. And while all the other Catholic school girls were at the mall with their mothers, we were in people's basements at channeling sessions and at psychics and in crystal shops. So yeah, I had this intense Catholic, all the sacraments, the communion, the confession, the confirmation, all the things. And I also had this spiritual thing running. My mother had a whole spiritual library, like Edgar Cayce and Seth and all of those things. And then my grandmother was more of that kind of what do they call them? Like farm witch kind of thing, you know, like where they like, if you needed a remedy, like you always had like some sort of remedy going on, you know, like if, you know, I remember like marinated onions for something for your colds and, you know, with hot sauce and whatever. And then she had, you know, it was just this coagulation of whatever works in the moment, do it. And so my mother, you know, who is now like, you know, so now we're in the 80s, right? And so my mom's taking me to crystal stores and everything. And I didn't care at that time. I didn't care. I was more interested in how can I win the horse shows. Like, I didn't care. I thought she was nuts. I thought my friends who thought she was fantastic were nuts. I thought they were all nuts. I just cared about, I want to make a lot of money so I can have a lot of horses and have a farm. Like, I didn't care. But in 1987, she took me to this crystal store and a book literally fell off the shelf into my hands. While she was at the front negotiating crystals, I was in the book section and this book fell into my hands and it was called Living in the Light by Shakti Gawain. And that's just a classic, iconic book. Anybody's getting on their spiritual path, I highly recommend it. Shakti has since passed, but I ended up having her on my show at one point, you know, when she did her re-release of that book, like the 25-year edition, she was on my show to promote it. So that was just like one of those moments. But yeah, I had Catholicism. And to this day, I will go to a Catholic church, not during Mass, but I find a groundedness because my inner child grew up in the Catholic church. And I say to people, when you're looking for your own balance, it's okay to go to the thing that your parents introduced you to get grounded and then come up out of that. So I will go to a Catholic church and say, like, if I'm feeling really off, we have a beautiful Catholic church here in La Jolla. It's called Mary Star of the Sea. And it's this little tiny settler's church right on the ocean. It is just the seagulls and the architecture. And it's just steeped with frequency. And when the doors are open all day and you have these cross breezes by the sea and you just go in there and you're like, if God isn't here, I don't know where he is. I don't know where he is. And so I can go and feel frequency. I could feel it in a temple. I could feel it in a mosque. I can feel it at a coven meeting. I can feel it. It's the feel, not the dogma, right? And I can go up against the best of them and tell the Catholic Church, look, that's flat. That's crazy. That's crazy that Jesus didn't do that either, you know? But I can still find peace wherever you go, there you are, right? And if you feel like today I'm feeling really quaky and I just wish, you know, both my parents have passed away now, and sometimes you just miss your parents and you just want to kind of do what they would have done, so you go sit in the church. My parents, we did Advent, we counted down the days to Christmas, you know, we had, you know, all of the sacraments, you know, they would go to church and my dad worked bingo and all those kinds of things, you know. So it's part of my structure, but it wasn't something that I necessarily walked away from. I folded it in like a cake, you know, it's just folded in as needed. You know, sometimes, look, you're going to try to be as organic as possible, but sometimes you need the amoxicillin. You know what I mean? You just need the antibiotic and you just say, okay, for today, we're going synthetic meds. That's it. There's no judgment. And then we can go back to the echinacea tomorrow. Sometimes you just need to knock something out. And I kind of feel that, I think that's kind of the flavor of how I handle the whole church thing. And my mother always, I said to her, if you're so spiritual and, you know, you're reading all these things and you're channeling, why the Catholic Church? And she says, I always wanted you to have structure so you knew what you're walking away from. I wanted you to have a home base. So as you went out to explore your spirituality or religiosity or whatever it is, you had kind of a core base and it gave you some, you know, something to push against if needed or something to come home to if needed. And I've used it like that my whole life. And I've never felt, you know, I had to be like anti-Catholic, you know, or I have to be Catholic. I have to be there on Easter. You know, I didn't, I was blessed to have these women who gave us a big permission slip. Now, I will tell you a very, very quick funny story, because you'll find this funny. When my mother had to have surgery, she had diverticulitis, and, you know, she was in the hospital and everything, and she was going to go into surgery the next day. She says, go home and get my Bible and my rosary beads. I said, what? But Ma, you have all these crystals, you have the tigers, you don't want the crystals. I need the real Jesus right now. We need Jesus. We need the Bible. We need the rosary beads. We'll get back to the crystals on Tuesday after the surgery. So she kind of, she would, that was a big permission slip, because when she felt like whatever she needed at that time that she was going to believe in to support her, that's what she would take up. Sorry, that was long-winded. I apologize.
No apologies. I just was sitting here loving every single word you were saying. And what I really dig about all of it is that it sounds like there was an openness and an open-heartedness and a welcoming almost of all these different traditions. I mean, I was listening to your story about the welding of the Star of David. And I think you said the
miraculous men. Yeah.
Yes. And I just thought, okay, is that not the most brilliant thing I've ever heard?
But somebody's got to be right.
Absolutely. But yeah. I think also it just indicates a willingness to welcome all those great gods and goddesses in to partner with you or begin a conversation as far as what that looks like. And I don't know, I'm just a little gobsmacked still. I used gobsmacked before, but I am, because I can't imagine many people taking that tack today, because everybody seems to want to pick a side, and it's only one side. So you can be Catholic, but you can't be Islamic. You can't be Hindu. You can't be Jewish. If you're Jewish, you can't be, think Sufism is great. But there's something incredibly generous of spirit and open-hearted about how they oriented themselves to the world.
Yeah, I don't think it's about being a particular religion. I think it's about which filter are you going to get your answers through. So my premise is, if God was going to create all of these, like, seven major religions and 600 types of divination and all those types of things, and create all these ways to have billions of people start a conversation with him, wouldn't there be at least one equally robust way of getting the answers back? Like, what's the structure of getting the answers back? And if you look at all of these religions, they focus very heavily on asking and waiting. And then they put a middleman in between you and the mysteries of the religion, the mysteries being the answers, how to get the answers back, right? How to interpret the answered prayer. That's the mysteries of any church, any mosque, of any temple. It's the answers, getting the answers back. What's the structure of being able to interpret, to perceive, receive, and interpret answered prayer? And if you look in the Judaism, I study Kabbalah and I'm certified Kabbalist. If you look in Judaism, essentially the mysteries of the temple were reserved for men over 40 years old. That's when you got to get how to get the answers back. In the Catholic Church, it's kind of sits with the Pope. You know what I mean? There's so many middlemen in the Catholic Church. When you get into the Baptist and the Protestants Church, now you've got these quote prophets, the pastor decides he's the prophet and everybody's talking in tongues and nobody understands what's going on. So there's a lot, And every single religion has its own version of that mysterious person, what they call a genie in Muslims, or like the Essenes in the Catholic Church. There's this mystical aspect of it that's been sequestered, and because that's where the power is. The asking isn't the power. And then people get caught up in the structure and the dogma. So then when they come to spirituality, they're looking for an oxygen mask, right? Because there's a lot of judgment to keep you at bay from being able to get the answers. Because they know if the public gets the answers and has a direct line and knows how to get the answers, then they don't need the middleman anymore. And then the power and the control are lost. And so I think it's really important to see religion as the filter of how do you get, what is the structure of permission slips for you to kind of get the answers? Do you have to genuflect? Do you have to say the gospel 10 times? Do you have to take communion every week? You know, I got kicked out of a few Catholic church Wednesday masses because I would just challenge the priest. I'm like, look, on Sunday, we took communion and we had to, you know, we had to say right before you get that you go up to get the communion, you say, Lord, I'm not worthy to receive you, but only say the word and I shall be healed. And they do these prayers and then you get on the line and you get to them and you go back and you kneel down, you say your prayers and you wait for them to put the plate out again for the money and to give you the announcements for what's going to happen in the church for the next week. And then the mass is over, you know, mass is ended, go in the peace, the love and serve the Lord. Okay, fine. But then you go back, they tell you come back next Sunday and they tell you, okay, here we're back to the communion thing again. And once again, you got to say you're not worthy, but only say the word and I shall be healed. And I'm like, okay, when did I go unhealed from last Sunday? Was it Monday? What did I do on? Was it Wednesday? At what point? You know, I'm saying this to the priest. I'm literally like 13 years old. I'm looking at the priest. Why are we doing this again? We just did this last Sunday. We were just unworthy last Sunday. Like, how is this like 52 Sundays? And high holy days, we have extra, like 54, because we've got a Christmas, Easter. So now we've got, you know, a lot of things. We got a lot of things going on, but we're always wrong. Is the wrong day? Do we go wrong on Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday? Like what happened? Right. And so this, I think that religion is a container for community. So you're with people of other, of like mind, you know, people who are coming together. I think it's some sort of structure to find your communication style. And then how do you want to be controlled? You know, like who's going to, you know, here comes the judge, like who's the judge. But once you get out of that and you kind of go, you swing the pendulum all the way over here and you decide, okay, I'm going to be spiritual. I find a lot of spiritual people still are religious. They just call, instead of Jesus, they call it the universe. And they still, oh, it has to teach me lessons. Oh, I'm getting punished by the universe. Oh, you know, I need to manifest. Like there's this still that they just swap out words, but they keep the dogma. They keep the cause and effect. They keep the judgment. And so I think for me, what's really helped my path is to look at it as, and this is what I teach my students, the more advanced you get in your energetic connections, the more you can participate in any religion you want without consequence, because I can go to a Catholic church in a Catholic mass. I could go to like midnight mass on Christmas Eve. And really, like when I go to New York City, if you want a miracle to happen, go light a candle at the St. Patrick's Cathedral, period, end of story. Just do it. If I would go into, when I go to Italy, you go to these different churches and the ancient frequencies in those buildings, because they're all made out of natural materials, that stone and that wood, it holds frequency. So you can be in your frequency-based state in any of these dwellings, synagogues, the Jewish religion is a beautiful, beautiful religion.
Yeah.
It's all beautiful. All of them can be beautiful until they're weaponized. And that's what we're all reacting to. We're reacting to the weaponization and the judgment and the shaming. And we're all just trying to find an air pocket. But when you have energetic autonomy, when you find your own connection and you discover your frequency-based physiology, your own language with your own higher self, then yeah, you can entertain any religion because you know that my connection is here. And if Joel Osteen says something that sits on my heart today and makes sense, then hello, Joel, let's go. Lakewood Church, you know, I'll listen to it any day of the week. And if T.D. Jakes makes some sort of perfect comment or what juxtaposition on something on Oprah or whatever, great. But do I have to be in their church every single day and I'm a wrong person, I'm a bad person, I'm going to hell if I'm not there? No, that's not, Christ doesn't even work like that. He doesn't even want you in there all the time. He's like, give me a break. Like, go do something. You've got this too.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. I love talking to you. You know, we were talking about your radio show/podcast that you started Oh, so long ago. And I am just intrigued. How did you even come up with doing this? Like, how did it occur to you that this was something you wanted to do? I mean, it's just so audacious, especially for the time that you were talking about. And was it so much fun?
I was terrified. The first I was. So I was doing readings at the time. Like, I had was sort of on my spiritual practice path, and I was trying to find what I called real estate so I could have people come to me instead of constantly going to psychic fairs and people's homes and doing these house parties. And I just needed a place where people could come and learn. I was feeling like there was something more than predictions, and that predictions were really getting people stuck. And I was certified as a medium. I was certified as a, you know, psychic and all these different things and animal communicator, all that stuff. And I was, you know, good at it. I did over 100,000 readings, like a lot. But I just needed I wanted a gathering place for something that was feeling like it was bubbling up in me. I was like, you know, people can do this themselves. Like, that. I don't think my purpose is to go around and be a gypsy, like predict things for people. I think that we're starting to move into a time where predictions are going to go out of vogue, and finding your own ability to personally connect and get your own answers is going to take center stage. So I think when I think back to all that time, now I was also in the film business and I was an actress and all that. So I was kind of in the media space to begin with. I was doing like film financing for producers and things, and I'd fly to Hollywood and negotiate things and stuff at that point. So I kind of understood what it was like to have a show and have like some sort of centerpiece of your practice and then have people come to you. And at that point, the only thing that was accessible to like regular people without having to go through like a Hollywood agent crazy process was the beginnings of these radio shows. We were starting, the internet was starting to find its established, it was starting to get its traction. And independent media was starting to find its way, you know, starting to get kind of be birthing itself. And there was a company called Contact Talk Radio, and it was, you could buy airtime. It would cost me $1,000 a month to buy airtime to do my show. And my very first show, I had a producer. You had a producer, you had a sound. My very first show, I had 30 pages of notes. And I think I talked to one person, which was my producer. I was the only person listening. And, you know, by five shows in, I had like four bullet points, and I could do a show, you know, with no notes at all at this point. But, you know, it was a very interesting time technology wise, because Facebook was just getting started back then. Like, you didn't have, there was no TikTok, there was no Twitter yet. It was MySpace and it was Facebook. And the flip video was just, YouTube was just barely started. Like, everything was really in its infancy. But the other thing was at that time too, was telesummits. That was a big deal back then, where, you know, these hosts would have like 10 speakers and they put you on some sort of platform. And I would sit and listen to those. I'm like, oh, I could do that. You know, I decided to try, and, you know, off we went.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
It's history.
Well, I so appreciate knowing how you kind of found your path to what you're doing now. And if you could describe a little bit about what the work you're doing now.
Well, now I have a practice that really focuses in on getting people introduced to their own energetic physiology. So we all have our physical physiology, our 3D side of ourselves, but we're also born with an entire dashboard and toolkit of energetic abilities and energetic tools that are frequency based. And it's, people kind of try to attribute it to spirituality or religion, And it's really physiology. We're really born with these kits of energetic abilities that were meant to be helping us 80% of the time. And our physical walkabout was meant to, you know, our mental minds and our intellect and analytical and logical and logistical abilities were meant to be, you know, really for organizing life in the tangibly in matter. But we weren't meant to divest ourselves completely from our frequency-based selves. And so I'm here to help people refine that. And, you know, wrote a book essentially for the, like, that's the missing operating manual for how to do that. And my biggest goal is, I guess, the first goal that was announced to me 10 years ago while I was on the shows was, we want you to help 1 million people get fluent in the language of their intuition. And I was like, oh, great. Okay. That's just fantastic. Yeah. Okay, fine. No problem. Like, what is that, you know? And eventually I realized that intuition was just a tiny thumbnail of an entire energetic communication system that we're born with. So my practice is really about not only getting people to be able to perceive and receive messages and send messages to their higher selves, but to be able to interpret those answers, to get that language of answer prayer and become so fluent in it that it's a conversational relationship that you have with your higher self, that it's a Batman and Robin relationship that you have with yourself. You can go back and forth. I record my channeled messages from my higher self into my phone. I have over 2,000 of them in my phone right now. One of my friends said, if you die, I don't want anything but your phone. I just want the files on the phone. When we have that, though, what that leads us to is my next thing, which is our mission. So there's a difference between a passion and a calling. And most of us have passions of some sort. I love dancing. I love riding horses. I'm not going to the Olympics on a horse, and I'm not going to be a fan. You know, I'm not going to be a dancer of, you know, Baryshnikov or anything like that. Those are passions. They're learning capsules. You learn about yourself when you go into a hobby or to a passion. You learn how to fight for it. You learn how to finance it. You learn about yourself through that medium, whatever that is. It could be cooking. It could be dancing, riding horses, you know, whatever, astronomy, whatever it is. But a calling is different. A calling is a partnership with your higher self. It's a partnership where the two of you have a mission to get something out to the world. And with a passion, you can fail. With a passion, you can go broke. Because that's all part of the learning capsule, right? Like, but with a calling, you cannot fail. And with a calling, it will always be bankrolled because it's for the greater good. It's a partnership. And most people get terrified of the word calling, especially Catholics, because back in the day when you were called, you were being called to be in the convent or called to be a priest, you know, more of a theological calling. So people kind of get worried about the word calling. You know, what does that mean? I don't want to be called. I don't want to be called. Okay. I just want to do what I want to do, you know. But when you get on point to your mission, to that calling, that's when you really... that's when life starts to really unfold and you start to have that frequency and substance, that integrated relationship with the physical and the non-physical as they were meant to be. And then your personal expansion is available to you. Your personal ascension is available to you because now you're working in partnership. And as you work in partnership with higher self to get that quote mission out to the world, you're receiving because people feel that. And so their energy comes to you and your energy goes out to them. And I think with everything going on in the world that we have going on right now, and all the infrastructure is literally just falling apart. The old systems are just falling apart. This having access, fluent access to these tools that are built in, now is the moment because that's the answer. Because look, AI is going to kick out a lot of jobs. The government, these guys kicking out people out of their jobs. And if you notice, the people who are being thrown out of their jobs, the most are the ones who have been in them for a very long time. They're in a very entrenched kind of a lifestyle. 30 years here, 25 years there. And we value that as a society. Wow, she was in that job for 25 years. How could they do that? And But what you have on the other side of that is so much entrepreneurship that never gets talked about in the government. Like the small businesses, entrepreneurship, solopreneurs are just never supported from a political perspective. It's kind of like, and it's a huge part of the economy is how many people, especially from after COVID, you know, how many people are in that space? I mean, there's plenty of us before, way before COVID, but that combined with AI, the only thing that's going to make you money is your mission. If you don't, if you're not connected in that energetic way and you're looking for man-made constructs to just pay bills, that whole system is no longer going to be able to carry people. It's just not. It's worldwide. You know, even, you know, you see all this stuff on China now because they're kind of doing their big campaign to, like, you know, all the things, answer the tariffs and everything. And when you look at all of that, I'm sorry if I'm dating your show, Kash, because it's like in a year, it's going to be like nobody cares about that anymore. But when you look at all of that, the answer to that is to go within. The answer to all of that is to say, okay, what's defining me? All these definitions, these luxury brands that are really only $5 instead of $35,000, all of these things, like the old markers for identity are collapsing. And my practice is to help you to find your new markers for identity, which is the connection with your higher self and the channeled guidance from your higher self, and then your higher self, and you can sort out the rest. But if you don't have that two-way conversational language, then it, you know, you can have charades, you know, oh, I think I saw 444. Oh, I was waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, I got a parking space because I asked for it from the angels. That's like going to France and knowing how to say bonjour and nothing else and talking in charades. Like, this is an actual language that you need. Like if you moved to France and you wanted to have a job, own a house, negotiate contracts, you need to be fluent in French. If you want to live your life to the highest and best, you need to be fluent in your language of your higher self, period. That's how you get your answers. And that's the thing where patriarchy is falling apart, because we're always looking for our answers. We're taught through the churches, we're taught through the way our governments run, we're taught through through the various markers in history where men were, you know, pressed in front and all that, that there should be, you know, an authority to tell us what to do, as opposed to a partner that connects us, you know? And yeah. So that's what my practice is really about helping people to do at this point.
I could literally just, I wish we lived closer because I would be at your house every day, not as like a stalker. I would have good boundaries, have healthy boundaries, but I'd find excuses to just amble on over to maybe borrow a cup of flour or something and then get into a long conversation with you. So, but I have to ask the final question of the podcast, or request, I guess I could say, which is, I would love and so appreciate if you would share a story, or it could be more than one story, where you feel like you've either witnessed or experienced something miraculous, magical, or mysterious. I would be so grateful.
Oh, that's a big vat of them. I have those things happen to me all the time. I think the one that comes up that spirit like brought right to the front was when I got mugged in Manhattan. And yeah. And so I was at the time in acting classes downtown in I was at HB Studio. So that was downtown. And we went to class and we, you know, did our whole scene study and all that stuff. And I had a couple of friends that, you know, from acting class, and we finished class and we went to a pizzeria, and I had my bag on the back of my chair. And when we went to pay for our pizza, my bag was gone. It was gone. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any credit cards. We didn't have cell phones at the time. And I ended up, my friends actually said, well, we have other things to do. Good luck. One of them gave me $20 and then they left me. And I was in the city by myself My car had a club on it. So my car was parked up in Midtown, and it had a club on the steering wheel. So I couldn't open it. I couldn't get in the car. So I called, I asked for help to get in the car. They wouldn't give me help because I didn't have the registration, because the registration was in the car and I didn't have my wallet. And, so it worked out that I got to a payphone. I called my dad, and he's like, because he's on Long Island. My mother was actually in the city at Lincoln Center. She was at a show. So I said, okay, let me walk all the way up to Lincoln Center now that's like 70 blocks from where I was, and to get to her, to get to the ballet, get to the show so I can find a way home with her. And I got all the way up there, and the show had ended, and she was gone. She wasn't there. Now, there's no cell phones. This was back in the early 90s. There were no cell phones. So I had discovered angels, and I had my guardian angel, Angelica. And I was like, I got to the point where the police wouldn't open the car for me. My mother wasn't there. I called my father, Colette, at home from a payphone, and he was like, I don't have time, but now I have to take a shower and come all the way into the city to get you, blah, blah, blah. I don't have time for this. So I really felt abandoned. So I called my friend Lydia, and my friend Lydia said, oh my God, I'm so glad you called me. A guy has your pocketbook. He's downtown, and your phone bill was in the pocketbook, and he looked to see who you called the most. And he called me, and he told me that he had your pocketbook, and he gave me the address, and I'm so glad you called. So here's the address. Go down there, and he's going to give you your stuff back. So long story short, I go all the way down. So I walk all the way back downtown. I use that $20 to get a cab, I think, I get to we're down in the village. Like there's no, street numbers anymore. I finally find this address. I get to this guy's house, and he opens the door, and he has my purse. He has my wallet, but there's no credit cards. The only thing that's left in there is there's no credit cards. There was no cash, but there was I had my registration. Now I have my car keys I had what I needed to get into the car. And I have my driver's license. And he hands me the purse, and he has no pupils in his eyes. Like, I'm just looking in his face, and I'm like, this. And he was a white guy with blonde hair. Like, he was almost iridescent. And he hands me this, and he opens the door just so much. And he says to me, here you go. And he hands me the thing. And I'm like, oh my God. Now, this was 6 hours later. I mean, this has been going on for 6 hours in Manhattan by myself. And I was just like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And he said, yeah, I found it in the park, and they had taken your wallet was over here, and the bag was over here, and something just said I should do this. And so I took the bag, and I said, oh, thank you. So I was so grateful. You're just exasperated. I turn around, and I'm, walking away. And then I turn around to look back at him, and he's not there. He's not there. So I finally get back up to my car. I get in the car, and I put my hand on the steering wheel. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe. So I'm about to drive home. And as I pull out of the parking space, a truck stops in front of me, and it's horizontal. And it says Angelica, my guardian angel's name, on the truck. And that was the first massive miracle I had ever experienced, and where I was really truly at the mercy of spirit. There was no, all of my intellectual, my intellectual smarts and my street smarts and being a New Yorker and a New York kid and all that just failed me. I did the best I could with what I had, but that was my first orchestrated energetic experience.
Wow. And I think, I grew up without cell phones and without the internet. And for people who did not, it is really hard to explain what it's like when you don't have instant connection, when you don't have this thing in your hand where you can call your parents, call for help. Some phones these days, they have their credit card numbers, so you can pay for things on your phone. We're talking about a time where everything would be in your purse, your entire life. So that if someone takes it or steals it, everything's gone. And by the way, it isn't so easy to just replace everything. I mean, you have to get on a landline. You have to start calling people. But not only that, for you, you had to find payphones, which were probably scattered all over the city. But yeah, you're still, you know, I can't even imagine, because everything's so easy for us these days.
Oh, so easy.
Yeah, you can't get lost because you have a map on your phone. Help is a few button pushes away. You're in contact with everyone pretty much all the time if that's what you want. But your story is really singular because it happened way before that, when you were really alone and in a spot where you had to ask for help because your mother was gone, your friends left you.
Yep.
And your dad's like, I don't want to come into the city.
Yeah. I mean, it's a trek to come from, you know, it's an hour back from Nassau County back into the city. And then you have to deal with the traffic. Plus it was a Saturday, and Saturday nights in the city, getting into the city is traffic jams and what have you.
Oh, I'm sure. And so to have, you know, this huge, I don't know, I would say trial/adventure. So you have this trial/adventure and you really needed help. And then at the end, there's this ratification in this truck with the name of your guardian angel. And I just think that's astounding. I mean, did you start laughing? Did you start crying? I would have been laughing.
I was gobsmacked. I mean, I was just like in awe, and I remember just bursting into tears because I was like, this is insane. Like but it was one of those things, you know, that aha moment, which that was before the words aha moment were kind of coined yet, but it was that moment where an aha moment is really when 3D and 5D French kiss, right? And you can perceive the infinite with 3D consciousness, right? Yeah. And so that was a moment that, I mean, and I've had thousands of synchronistic stories, because that's part of the energetic communication language, is synchronistic kinds of stories. We consider them miracles until they become normal. And then we realize, oh, that's just part of the energetic communication process, right? But when you're not fluent in that, it just feels like this miraculous thing. And it was, don't get me wrong, it was. There's plenty of that out there. But I think, you know, when you, it's just a powerful, visceral, that feeling of connection is, I don't even know if there's an emotional equivalent. So all of your senses just get like waterfalled, right? That's why you end up, it's goosebumps, and you're just like this, whoa, like, you know, people go, whoa, you know, it's like all the space within your cells, because we're more space than we are matter. So it's almost like this whoosh that comes all the way through our bodies, goes in through the front, out through the back, and you're just like, whoa, you know, you just feel that there is something more. And I just touch that, you know, and people crave that, right? People lately, and I'm sorry, there's a little anecdote, but lately I've been watching a tremendous amount of YouTube videos on Côte d'Azur, living in the south of France and Italy, right? And it's just the Amalfi Coast, Positano, you know, Florence and Tuscany and Cannes and Côte d'Azur, you know, Mochon and all these, you know, Provence and all these different places. And I've just been fascinated. It's just, you know, nervous system management, just how you relax. And I'm not going to move to Europe or anything like that, but I like to flirt with the idea because it just feels good right now, especially it's like, okay, get me out of here. Okay, let's go buy some more kumquats at the market. Okay, yeah, okay. You get on Instagram, you're doom scrolling, you're like, okay. So what did she buy? What is she? Oh, the butter from the goats? Okay, let's talk about that. Like, you know, but what I find is that when you get into these ancient places, and people are attracted to that. They're not just going because they can get their own grapes and have wine and eat cheese. They're going because of a deep connection and a reduction of noise. Because the one thing that's consistent across all of these YouTubers who are overseas, these expats who are overseas now trying to, you know, stay there, you know, financially, so they have a YouTube channel, is they talk about the simplicity and how getting the vegetables of the season or the making the sauce or sitting and painting in their yards or, you know, watching the sunset, there's a presence. And I think the challenge for us, or the invitation, not the challenge, but the invitation for us is, can you find that presence anyway? Anyway being the operative word. Can you find that presence in your own home? Can you set boundaries on your social media? It is wonderful that we're this connected. It's the power. It's going to keep us alive and going. It's our power, but it's also our poison. And how do you take your power back? You look at an image, an inspirational image, like a woman in Provence with her little straw hat on and her bag as she's walking down the cobblestone streets to the market to get her baguette. They don't eat enough over there. I'm like, what is going on? Like, is this dinner? Oh, we just cut up a leek and we had to cut up a fennel and then we're going to have a pirate, so whatever, and we're going to have this and a glass of wine. I'm like, that's it? Like, I don't even understand. Like, what's happening right now? But that's another day's conversation. But, you know, they don't eat enough. But what they do eat is such high quality. And I guess maybe once you're, you know, and they're walking up all those stairs, I'm like, she's got to be hungry. There's no way she's going. But they, you know, the quality of the ingredients and the reduction of the cortisol, they may not need any more food, because the food is now, for them, it's just fuel and it's a way to texturize their experience of their life. It's not a replacement. It's not a numbing agent, you know? So I feel like that the more we get connected to our frequency-based selves, the less we need to numb. And that's what people are searching for. So they go to these ancient places. They talk about the steeped in the, you know, this, the frescoes on the ceilings. And someone did this in 1200 and 200 and BC and what, all these other old things. And they're buying these ruins. You know, like, my God, that's falling apart. Are you okay? You know, but they're searching for the energy. But they're saying it's the architecture. It's not. I went to Florence, and when I was in Florence, I was a ballroom dancer, and we danced, and we had a dance competition in Italy, and we danced in Venice and went through Tuscany and Florence and what have you. And when we went to, there was a certain place in Florence, I got on this one street, and I knew where everything was. I'd never been there before. And then this little gypsy woman, this Italian gypsy, had a little tin table and a little, what looked like a bomb. It was a little torch light. And she did readings. And so I had a reading with this little gypsy lady. It's something to get from another culture, a reading from another culture, because they're no joke. Like, those people are very connected. And I remember sitting there and just knowing, like, I've done this before. I've been here before. There's this, because the ancientness is still present. You know, like, New York is very ancient. There's all kinds of, you know, where you are, where I am, you know, in California, we're sitting on so much ancient land, on so many, but there's no evidence of that. We can't see, there's so much technology and so many glass buildings and so much rebuilds and teardowns, and there's no reverence for anything, you know. So when you go over to Europe, I think when people get there, they're just so moved. They're trying to find their frequency and they can't articulate it, but they feel it in the ancientness of the ruins. They're like, oh, and it awakens something, and then they don't want to leave. People have that experience in places in, like, Sedona, here in California, Southern California, certainly. You know, it's a very interesting New York City. There's various ley lines, various pockets here in the U.S., but I think people are very enamored by Europe because so much of their ancientness is still there, still intact. You know, so you can kind of, the textures and the feeling is still there, because that doesn't go away.
And that's it. That's a wrap on my conversation with Mari. I hope that you enjoyed meeting her and finding out all about her and all the groovy stuff she's done in her life thus far. I did think it was actually really fabulous that she had this radio show early on when podcasts weren't really a thing. And now you see what's happening. There's like 4 million, I think, and counting all over the world. So she really is one of those people who seems to show up at these inception points and create things that are ahead of the curve. If you'd like to know a little bit more about her and what she's doing, there will be a link in the episode's show notes. I do encourage you to do a deeper dive and discover a little bit more about this beautiful human being. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Please give me a rating or a review on Apple. I am at 99. I just need one more to get to 100. I have been hustling so hard. So if someone who's listening to this feels it in their heart to give me a rating or review on Apple, I would be so grateful. But otherwise, you know what I'm going to say. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Mari. Be bold. I mean, think about what this world needs. Think about what it's aching for, what it's yearning for, how you can feed the world with the work that you're doing or the work that you have yet to be doing. Because honestly, sometimes we don't know what our good and big work is going to look like until we're in the middle of it. So dream big like Mari. Dream beautifully like Mari. Dream generously like Mari, and bring that beauty and your good works to others. Who cares what other people say? They might not understand your vision. They might not understand just exactly what it is you're going for. But do it. I just say, just do it. Go out there, be brave, create beauty, and shatter. Yes, I mean really, really shatter everyone's expectations while creating gorgeousness everywhere you go.